The Problem Gambling Podcast is proudly sponsored by Gamban, the simple and effective way to block access to online gambling on all your devices. If willpower slips, Gamban doesn't. Go to gamban.com to find out more.
Hello and welcome to the Problem Gambling Podcast. My name is Tony O'Reilly and I'm an addiction counsellor at Exeter and Problem Gambling. My co-host is not here today. He's on a meeting that he couldn't get out of. So I'm here to do a solo run today and I'm joined by Nick, aka the Gambling Guard. And Nick uses his experience of his gambling addiction to, he uses the platform of social media to get his message across of recovery and that recovery is possible. So Nick, thanks a million for joining us today. How's things with yourself?
Yeah, good. Thanks, Tony. Thanks for having me on. Good to meet you, mate.
Thanks a million for coming on. So I suppose just to start, maybe you could just give us a snapshot of how you got to the point of sharing your story online.
Yeah, so I'm 36. I suffered a 12-year gambling addiction, which was from 2007 to 2019. In the process, losing around £500,000. Virtually all online. I think I went into a bookies probably two or three times in my life. And then entering recovery in 2019, at the very end of 2019, December, I then entered recovery and as part of that, I set up Gambling Guard, mainly as a journal, which was recommended to me from a counsellor. Sort of a modern day journal, if you like. But then also because all of my addiction was online, I wanted to do something in the online space, if you like, to try and, you know, hopefully prevent or stop some people going down the path that I did. So,
brilliant. Yeah, I was probably a little bit more old school. I was suggested to write a journal and I actually wrote it while I was in treatment, a hardback book of just my day to day, which elements of that were taken for the book. I was able to give Declan Lynch all my journals and all my betting history, and that's where that was the basis of the book. So I found that really, really beneficial while I was in treatment to kind of get my thoughts and feelings down on paper to stop them swirling around my head at a time when there was hundreds of thoughts flying around my head in regard to the impact my gambling had, or you know what was to come down the line. So I really did find it hugely beneficial to get that out on paper. But I think, you know, like I'm not on TikTok. I know a lot of your videos are on TikTok. My little one is on it, and she's showing me all her dances. She doesn't. but it's brilliant. Like following you on Twitter, you post up a lot of those videos, and I think it's really, really, they're done in such a way that it catches the attention and gets that message out in a different way. Like that's what I found. I think that's really, really important because, you know, I would tweet articles, or I would, you know, maybe have comments on articles, or, you know, give a little bit of insight into one area. But the power of visual, I think, can be brilliant to get that message across to maybe a section of people who mightn't read articles or who might just want that video content of a couple of seconds or a couple of minutes.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it started in lockdown, and I think that's when TikTok really sort of, you know, picked up because everyone was in the house, so they were entertaining themselves through doing the dances, whatever. I don't do any dances, that's the first thing to say, but I decided it might be quite a good way to try and reach the sort of younger generation, because my addiction started when I was in uni. You know, student loan, you've got the money, you've never had that much money in your bank account before, and you've got so much free time. It's a bit of a perfect cocktail for addiction, really. So that was what it was geared towards, you know, the sort of the uni, 18 to 25 demographic. I knew it would alienate a lot of people. I knew a lot of people wouldn't like it, but there's other stuff and other help available for them. This was a way to try and reach, you know, people who may not have been reached, because one thing I did find on Twitter, I found it a lot of sort of people talking to each other almost. And I'm not, that's not to say that the people talking to each other from there weren't helping people outside of social media. Obviously they do. But I just felt there was a better way to connect to people on social media.
Yeah, I suppose TikTok, it's a couple of seconds long or a minute. I don't know exactly the format of it. I think it's a minute long or whatever it is. But it's, you know, people can flick onto it, but it's a message that's given within that. I know your videos have a specific kind of message in each one. And I know it's a journal of your recovery, as well as things that have helped you in recovery. And I think it's excellent because I think it does bring it to a different cohort of people. Like we will talk about in counseling, we'll talk about, you know, there's loads of different pathways into addiction. You know, it could be behavioral conditioning, it could be personality disorders, it could be stuff like stress, anxiety, boredom, you mentioned time. But also there's plenty of pathways into recovery. And I think, and plenty of pathways to give that information out there. You know, like some people, GA meetings would be their main form of recovery. Some people, it could be a self-help book. Some people, it could be counseling. And in other cases, it might be residential treatment. But also, it's important to get our message out in different ways. And I think, I was just thinking about before we got on, that there's, I know in Ireland, there seems to be, the tide seems to be turning, because I think we are, between all these different platforms and like a lot, so many people who are courageous enough to put their stories out there, to put their message out there, I think it is starting, the message is starting to get out there that gambling isn't just all about its fun. Now, for many, and we always say this, for the majority, it is an element of fun. But there's been so many people being impacted by this. It's good to get that message out there at a time when maybe, I'm speaking in Ireland, I suppose, we don't have that message coming from the government or coming from the health departments. So it's good that it is getting to people and people say, no, hold on, maybe... No, maybe we need to think about this in a different way. So I think that's really beneficial.
Yeah, and it's interesting you mentioned about the government and health departments as well, because do you know Stacey Goodwin as well, the girl gambler? Yeah. So me and her were invited onto this NHS England panel last week to talk about like lived experience and social media and stuff. And I think that was a good sign, because hopefully it means maybe the health departments or the NHS or whatever are opening up to the fact that, and I don't know how to say this, because I do, you know, I firmly obviously believe that addiction is an illness, but I'm not convinced that approaching it with sort of medical language is the best way to connect to people. And I know it myself. I mean, let's say I was, you know, I was in addiction for 12 years, and I think there's a bit of arrogance behind addiction. Personally, I think there's a lot of, particularly gambling addiction. You know, you always think you can get out of it. You always think you're going to win your next bet and stuff. That's not to say the people who are addicted are arrogant, but I think the addiction, you know, sort of facilitates a bit of ego to continue with it. And I never wanted to sort of put myself in the category of a suffering gambler or a failed gambler or whatever it might have been in my mind at the time. So I think by approaching things more with humor, you can sort of crack into people a bit more, maybe like the, you know, lad culture and all the rest of it. If you can almost, and I hope this comes across in the right way, but if you can also sort of subtly take the piss a little bit and get people to look at themselves in that way, that is going to reach a lot of people who won't want to identify with the victim, you know, open close brackets on, you know, on the campaigns and stuff. That might be right, that might be wrong, people might disagree, but that's how I felt. So I thought, well, if that's how I felt, I'm sure there must be people feeling the same.
Yeah, I often say, like, the three things stop me getting support at a time when I probably saw my gambling as definitely moved along that continuum to kind of heavy or at risk or problematic. I always say it was fear, pride, and ego stopped me from looking for that support. And like I remember when my addiction came to light and I went for treatment, it was 2011. Like, there was nothing out there around gambling addiction. I mean, absolutely not. I remember I've said it on the podcast before, there's Oisin McConville, who had written a book about his gambling addiction. And I remember frantically trying to get this book somewhere before I went into treatment, thinking this is going to have all the answers. there was very little information online around it. I know it was only entered into the DSM-5 2 years later, like as an addiction akin to substance use disorder. So it was only, the movement was really only just starting to gain momentum. So when it got into the DSM-5, I think that's when the research and that's when the topics of conversation around it really started to open up. And there was a lot more information out there. But I would very much agree, like, you know, Barry now is a self-confessed nerd when it comes to gambling regulation, legislation and stuff like that. I am the opposite. I will actually nearly cringe away from reading a report around gambling. Like, that's why myself and Barry work well, because that's what he does and I do my thing.
Yeah.
But I would be very much, I'd connect into a story or connect into an idea a lot quicker than if I was reading pages upon pages of it. And I think that's why, you know, it's kind of funny you said that about the pandemic or the lockdown. That's why you'd start doing the videos. That's when we decided to do this, because we were kind of saying, like, what could we do to kind of reach an audience when we probably can't as much? And we're trying to fill in our days and fill in our times as well. So I remember Barry sent me, well, we'll just do a podcast. And I was going, oh, Jesus, no, please, no. I would rather do anything. I'd be comfortable talking on radio shows or TV or whatever. But when it was kind of a podcast where you have to talk an hour and you're inverted commas perceived expert on the thing, which I'm not. I'm not even an expert in my own recovery at the best of time. But it's, I think that was our way of trying to get the information out there in a different way as well, rather than just maybe a tweet around, this is our service. People will listen to the podcast and people will kind of, you know, they can take it or leave it. They can turn it on when they want. They can turn it off when they want. And I think it did reach a different group of people who may not have got the message of what gambling is. And I think, again, I've often said it, like there's a few people I've contacted who don't have a gambling addiction and listen to the podcast because they find the subject matter and the guests really, really interesting. And I think that's really important for us as people in recovery who are kind of advocates for change to get that message out there to as many people as possible. Because some people will read academic papers, some people will read books on the subject. And saying that, like, as I said, I have Jackpot here by Rob Davis is actually propping up my my microphone here. So that's my next book to read to kind of get an insight into gambling. And it's really good that all those are out there, but it's also brilliant that we have different forms of information. And I know yourself and Stacey have been very at the front of doing the videos, forefront of doing the videos on TikTok. So that's how I got to kind of know your kind of story. But maybe just for people who are listening, maybe just to give a snapshot of that journey of addiction, because you said you started in uni. So had you experienced a bet before that, or had it been a part of your life? Because I know in my own story, I was 24 and I placed my first bet, and which is relatively fairly late in comparison to what we're seeing nowadays. Now, again, that was 98. So it's a different landscape totally to what it is now. So 2007, you were saying was when you started gambling, was it?
Well, so 2007 is when I would say I became addicted. But my first bet was in 2004. You know, like yours in the World Cup, right? The Argentina game, whatever. Mine was, it was the League Cup semi-final between Middlesbrough and Arsenal in 2004. I was in sixth form. We were on a break at lunchtime, walked into town. My mate supported Arsenal. I support Spurs. So it was a £10 bet, really just as a bit of banter with my friend who supported Arsenal. Inevitably, as I'm sure you guessed, the bet won. So that, you know, that sort of sowed the seeds. But, you know, by no means did I leap straight into daily betting or regular betting. But, you know, what I did do then was bet on the big tournaments. So Euro 2004 came in the summer, and I remember losing a few hundred quid on that, which at the time as a sixth form student, you know, was all the money I was getting from working in the local corner shop and stuff. But didn't really see it as a problem, just viewed it as a major tournament, you know, bit of entertainment or whatever. But I would then, you know, bet occasionally, certainly not every weekend, maybe if there's a big game on in the pub or whatever. But yeah, it was really when I went to university and then I had a student loan. I come from a low-income background, so I had a maintenance loan. So I had, you know, all of this money, you know, I think, you know, in the first term, it's a couple of grand or whatever it was. And I'd never had that much money in my bank before. And I had loads of free time. And, you know, as a quirk of historical fate or whatever, the Gambling Act in the UK had just been passed. So all the advertising was deregulated and, you know, all the rest of it. So suddenly you had all these Ray Winston ads and you had everything else, you know, all the time suggesting how to bet. And it sounded like a great idea to me. I like sport. I like football. I think I know my football. So I would start betting. And what became a bet, you know, in games I was watching, quickly became a bet in games I wasn't watching. Quickly became betting on games I knew nothing of, at times, you know, of all three of the day, you know, which obviously is similar to your story as well, you know, staying up through the night, betting on various sports. But the sort of honest thing is then at the time, I almost viewed it as going through a bit of an apprenticeship. Because if you were to, I was at uni, but if you were to ask me what I wanted to be at that point, I wanted to be a professional gambler. Like I loved it. I loved the odds. I loved doing the research. You know, I say research as if it made any difference, but I loved the whole process of it. And, you know, I was on Twitter at the time, obviously just a personal account. And I could see that people were allegedly betting professionally, you know, the betting tipster accounts and all the rest of it. And I thought, great, I want a piece of that. So whilst studying at uni, I was almost regarding myself as studying to be a gambler and accepting the fact that I would lose at the time because I was learning my trade, so to speak.
Yeah, and I suppose the reason I kind of focused in 2007, that's when smartphones, I think, started to really come in. So like I, story is very similar because I, in my own, like mine stayed at an okay level for 5 years from 98 to 2003. And then when I opened up my online account, it was like a different world. You know, it really was. No, I was gambling from the comfort of my room on a PC in my bedroom. So I was kind of, it was the ease of access, availability. It was that thing of, I didn't have to get into a car, drive down to the bookies, fill in a docket, hand it in, maybe at times get money out of the bank. I could just, you know, jump onto my chair and log on to my account and place a bet. But in 2007, then when the smartphones came in and the apps really came to the fore, I think that made it so much more accessible. So if you are in college, you have an hour or two free during the day, if you have free classes or free time, it's just a matter of taking your phone out and going on and checking odds and doing the research while you're there, as well as the gambling while you're there. Because a lot of times, like when I'm telling the story, it's kind of like, I would talk about maybe gambling 20 hours a day, but that's not that I'm physically placing bets for 20 hours. I'm researching, I'm thinking about it, I'm thinking of scenarios, I'm trying to get money together. It just consumes everything. And if you have that information on your phone, or the ability to be able to gamble on your phone, it makes it so much more accessible. And I think that can really drive a gambling problem quicker. I suppose what we're finding in our service at the moment is that the cohort, as I was saying, of people looking for support has definitely dropped, but also the length of time that it's taken them to for it to become a problem is definitely after shortening a lot. I mean, 6 months a year, like you mentioned, your addiction kind of developed over a number of years. I would say mine was over probably 10 years as well. So it's kind of, I think it's because of the rise of technology, it's just been bombarded with advertisement. We're being bombarded with messages to gambling from Ray Winston, and it's been normalized in sport, as we know from looking at a game. You're being subject to gambling advertisement, and we know that Gambling with Lives and the Big Step are doing absolutely amazing work in trying to bring that to the fore, bring it into light. So I think I think when you do drift online, I think it's a different animal. I think it's like the Declan Lynch, who co-wrote the book with myself, he'd always call it like nearly like a different addiction altogether. It's like they would say like that, and Barry, I know, mentioned it last week, you know, the slots being the crack cocaine of gambling. But online for me was definitely something that elevated very, very quickly, because It's just you're gambling on emotion, because once you're looking at a live sports event, especially if you're watching Spurs and you have Harry Kane to score first, Stone scores first, you're kind of going, oh, he's going to score next. So you have the ability to keep going back. I think that's when the problem can develop very, very quickly, because I will always say that in-play betting and gambling with credit were the two things that accelerated my addiction. But the one bit I didn't probably put in there is that the ease of access of being able to be in play while you're sitting in the pub, while you're watching a game, or while you're having your dinner at home, or while you're sitting watching it at home. That's, I think that's where the problem is. So you've definitely kind of recognized that the online aspect was definitely a different part of your addiction, or definitely accelerated, I suppose.
Yeah, for sure. As I say, first bet in 2004, you know, I regard my addiction in starting in 2007, because that is when I set up my Betfair account, you know, and that's when it came. And yeah, like I, you know, got into, you know, very significant credit card debt from gambling, you know, by the time I left uni, and then it continued even when I started working. And there's so many factors about the online gambling that I think contributed to my addiction, you know, just in the way that the addiction had sort of, hijacked my brain, if you like. I was obsessed with looking at the potential wins, like obsessed with. I could stare at it, you know, probably vacantly for 10 or 15 minutes. Just I had a bet on, and the, you know, the potential returns was, you know, whatever hundreds or whatever thousands it would have been for some outlandish bet. And I was obsessed with that, and I would already then, you know, be planning what I was going to do with the win, with the winnings. Okay, so that's 2.5 on the midday kickoff, so at 3 o'clock, you know, and I was doing all these different elaborate Excel spreadsheets of permutations and different ways that I could spend my winnings, because yeah, I was just so enthralled with, you know, you add one more leg in and look what the potential winnings comes. So it goes from 600 to 2.5 grand. And that's only for West Ham to beat Leeds. Like, they'll probably, I mean, what, another 2 grand? Yeah, you'll put it in. And you just, you know, you build and build and build in that way. But even, as you say, if you're watching the football, the instantaneous aspect of being able to bet on it, whether you're caught up in the emotion of a team you support or not, in a way that you just couldn't do. You know, if I had to drive into town or walk into town to go into a bookies, I personally never would have done it. I didn't enjoy the experience of being in a bookies. You know, it's a massive stereotype, but for me it was true. My local bookies were filled with pensioners, you know, old men betting on the horses and stuff. I just wanted to go in and bet on football, you know, or bet on boxing. I wasn't interested in anything like that. So I didn't want to be in that environment. But there was a certain glamour, I think, to betting on your phone, you know, when you did win, because gambling did win a lot as well. You know, you end up being back at zero, but you do win a lot. You know, the dopamine I would get from seeing those numbers on the screen was just extreme. And then you would reverse withdrawals anyway, so it would go straight back in, because you saw another thing that caught, you know, it was another little bit of treasure that caught your eye.
It's amazing. Like, everything you're saying, I can totally resonate. But the other bit with the dopamine hit I used to get as well was the, I used to gamble with Paddy Power, but I used to watch the results of the games on Betfair or Bet365. So I used to get that hit when the screen used to gray out as suspended betting was suspended. Now, this is, you're looking back to 11 years ago. I know that they have these kind of little pitches now that it talks about attacks or dangerous attacks. So you're all constantly getting that, is something going to happen here? And then even that screen will kind of go blank, and then it'll either be a corner or a shot blocked or something. So we're constantly getting those hits during the bet. And definitely is the emotional thing kicks in, I think, when gambling, because you can have all the systems, you can have all the everything in place, but we can't take out the human aspect of it. That when a bet does go down, you want to continue to bet on that match to try to get the money back. Like, I was going through my online betting history at one stage, and there was one particular Saturday that I think Liverpool were playing Newcastle. I think I had 6 bets on Liverpool to win the game. So obviously What was happening is I put them in the initial accumulator, and then obviously they went to goal down, so I put them in again. And then another bet might have gone down or been a goal down, so I go back in and do the same bet again. And then it ended up that I'd done 6 or 7 different versions of my first bet based on the teams that were losing in at the time. And when you, you're laughing because you can definitely associate that. It's like, it's absolutely total madness when you think about it, but that's how we get caught up in this. That's how the online aspect of it is a totally different type of gambling, I feel, than placing your bet on a horse race, watching the event, winning or losing, and then deciding to do it again. This is constantly, and if you can, this is constant. If you can imagine, like, the games are kicking off at different times. So, like, the Liverpool game could be finished, but I might have had 2 other teams in on that, and then they're still going, and then I see another ones that are upcoming, and I put them in as well. So you can actually be gambling for on the strength of your initial first thought for hours, and just adding stuff in on it. And I think that's the dangerous element of online gambling, because you don't get that break, and you don't get that ability to really look rationally at what you're doing. And of course, the gambling companies will say, take time to think, or, take that break, or, take a time out is another one. But when you're in that mindset, you can't take a time out. You know, like the irrational, there's a great book called The Chimp Paradox. He talks about the chimp brain and the rational brain.
Steve Peters,
the chimp brain just takes over. In the same way, like, I remember watching, I think it was Wolves and Man City a few months ago. And one of the players, Jimenez, got booked. And he knows deep down, if he stands in front of the ball and stops them taking a quick free kick, he's going to get booked again. But again, the chimp brain kicked in and he stood in front and got sent off. And then he's going away kind of surprised. How did I get sent off? And kind of, but he knows deep down the rules of the game. But in that moment, he's caught up in the emotion of felt hard done by because he didn't get a free and then lunged in and he gave away a free. And how many times do we see that in sport where the rational thinking or the rationalization will go out of it altogether and the chimp brain will kick in? And I feel that's the same with gambling, because all the rationalization goes out and the emotion comes in. And if you're watching the game and you are placing bets on it, that emotion is even higher. And you were saying, like myself, at the start, you would be placing bets on teams you knew about, but then you'd be watching games because you had a bet on. And suddenly you're invested in kind of second division German teams. You're getting to know all the players because you're so invested in them. And then it's kind of going like, how does it get to that? Because we're basing our decisions based on the odds that are put up by the bookies. We don't know anything about these teams other than the league table. And then what we will try to do is we will research it. And then we're starting to back our own decisions based on that. But the problem is then that there's so many variables within sport or within gambling that inevitably something's going to let you down. And as you said, I've won big as well. But the problem is that the psychological part only keeps you going nearly until that's zero. And that's the bit that I find hard to get my head around at times while in recovery. How did I let myself get to that without stopping? But I understand it a lot more because elements of that comes in with different behaviors in my life.
Yeah, I personally think, it's something again that I've seen firsthand with the people who contact me and stuff. Competitive people, perhaps sporty people, or competitive people, are particularly at risk of gambling addiction, because you are always looking for that win. And I work in sales, and started working in sales in 2009. So whatever, if I had a particularly good day at work and did a deal, whatever, I would go home on a high and then I would come home and feel flat. So I'd be like, right, I need to find another win. So where's the win going to come from? Okay, well, it's Champions League tonight. That's easy. But if it was on a, any particular day of the week, and so there's no Champions League, there's nothing I can even pretend to know about. Oh, but there is the Portuguese Segunda Liga playing. Don't know any of the players or the managers, but they're top of the league. They've won six out of 10 at home. That looks good. That would do. And that would be enough for me to try and get that win. And then the dangerous thing on the flip side is if I was to have a bad day at work, I was still looking for a win and looking for a win even more. And that would be even more of then a desperation win, because I'm just desperately trying to get some kind of dopamine or validation in myself from somewhere. And that would always be gambling. But yeah, I was laughing because you said about the Liverpool Newcastle thing, and I would load up on one team. So I'd always, in my mind, it was always like, right, I'd have one banker on the weekend, and I would base loads of single bets around them. I would base loads of accumulator bets around them, and it was all hinging on them. And then that wasn't enough, because I, you know, a lot of what I enjoyed was looking at the recommended win. So then it became my banker team had to be minus 1.5. So they had to win by two or more goals. And then I would also put in the minus 2.5 and 3.5. So every weekend I was basically expecting someone to be absolutely hammered, which obviously isn't the way it would go. And then inevitably, if those bets would lose, the most dangerous thing for me, again, about the online addiction is that the money has no sort of, it's not rooted in reality. It's just numbers on the screen. So I might have lost 500 quid on the midday kickoff, because it's then, you know, it's also fallen down all of the rest of my bets for the day. So all I would do is just start again. And then I would do it all again at 3 o'clock. And then at the 5 o'clock tea time kickoff, and then at 7:45. And then the Major League Soccer would kick off at 10, or it would just go on and on and on and on. And you could genuinely ask me, and I asked myself, even in addiction, you know, you get like fleeting moments of self-awareness and stuff. I would ask myself sometimes, be like, oh, you know, Christ, I've lost probably a little bit here, probably about 200 quid. And it would be 2 grand. But genuinely, I thought it was about 200 quid. You know, it's almost like a trauma block. You lose a bet, it's gone. You forget about it. People say, like, you know, the highest most of gambling. Yeah, to a degree. But I, you know, the losses didn't really impact me, because I literally just blocked them out.
Yeah, it's literally like a dissociation, isn't it? Because you can block it out, and because that allows you to continue the behavior. And that's a coping skill as well. And it's mad, like you say, like, you know, if you lost the 3 o'clock kickoffs, you'll chase them at the 5 o'clock kickoffs. But also, if you won the 3 o'clock kickoffs, you'll be chasing the four wins, because you'll see there's a pattern. My luck is in. I may keep going. If I can't stop now while my luck is in, or I'm wearing my lucky underpants today, but that's my fucking. But also, it's that whole concept of chasing losses or chasing wins. And, you know, chasing losses is one we always talk about in gambling. But it's chasing wins as well as equally as dangerous, and that we're nearly as vulnerable after a big win as we are after a big loss. And I think, yeah, you touched on, you know, competitive people very much would be more susceptible to gambling. And that's borne out in some of the research to say, and I suppose it's borne out in lots of kind of big sports stars coming out talking very publicly about their addiction as well. Like we have Paul Merson, Peter Shilton, a good few GAA players in Ireland. And it's that thing of finding that the replacement for the buzz of scoring that winning goal or being on a pitch in front of thousands of people. But also, I think, like, I wouldn't see myself as a very competitive person in sport-wise, but also in kind of work-wise, I was very competitive. I wanted to get to the top of my field. But I also kind of, I suppose, from chatting to Barry over the years as well, it's kind of, I think there's, and I think Gabor Mate talks about in his book, In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, I believe I have a dopamine deficiency. So it's kind of, I always need something to kind of make me feel better. And for me, that was always buying things or having nice things around me. And then gambling kind of gave you the ability to buy more of that, but also to feel less guilty about doing that. So, and also the feeling that I got from gambling kind of replaced that feeling of buying something. So it's that dopamine hit, or whether it's the near miss, or even if there's a loss, you'd still get some kind of hit. So definitely, I think there's definitely a lot of stuff going on in the back of my weird and mad mind in regards to where my gambling addiction came from. I've kind of compartmentalized a lot of it and figured out a bit of it, but it still comes back in other ways. You know, like I'll go down and buy vinyl. I have this thing about, you know, I have a certain amount of albums I want to buy in vinyl. And I go down when you mightn't have exactly the money to spend on it, but you go down, I need to do it today. Like, for example, it was kind of funny how my head went the other day. Like, and this is how you kind of
the emotion bit takes over. Like, I'm a big fan of The Cure. So The Cure were playing with churches that had the song How Not to Drown. And I think it won some award at the NME Awards. So I'm on Twitter and you're seeing them on stage performing it together. And I like churches as a band. And I'm kind of thinking, yeah, I have Spotify. I'm going to listen to the album. And because I'm caught up in the emotion of watching the video and liking the two bands, I'm thinking, right, I have to get the CD of that now. Even though I haven't listened to the album since it came out. I listened to it while driving the other day, but I had to have that CD in my hand. And the same happened with Eddie Vedder album that was out a couple of weeks ago. And I'm sitting at home and I'm organizing my whole day to, and even kind of minimizing the time I get to spend with my daughter, kind of, I need to get downtown for an hour to go into the local record shop to pick up this album, to have it in my possession. And then when I have it in my possession, it's kind of going, okay, is that it? So it's kind of like it's nearly on a shelf then, and then you look at it, and then you might play it for a year or two, then you sell it back secondhand, having not even listened to it. So it's that need to get that dopamine hit. And that's the scary thing, because I sat with it the other day and I kind of went, this is wrong. This shouldn't be the way. And even like in long-term recovery, these elements of needing to do that is still there. So I really have to look at what's driving that need or that behavior. And lots of time it's boredom, it's tiredness, it's emotion, it's overwhelmness, it's burnout, it's all these other things that definitely were probably there because of my or during my gambling addiction. And it's something I have to be so mindful of, because I'm capable of, you know, I was capable of blowing hundreds of euro without even thinking about it in gambling, but I'm also capable of doing that with shopping if I don't have the control measures in place. Now I have a very strict control measures in place around money even now, but I always find little ways around them. I always get that little pocket of 50 euro here or 100 euro there. And that's the bit that scares me most, because if I didn't have that really good control measure, what way would my spending be? So even though the gambling is, and touch wood, it hasn't been a part of my life. Well, it's been a big part of my life because I'm working in the area, but the gambling addiction hasn't been a part of my life. The behaviors are constantly there the whole time. And it's something I have to be really mindful of, because it's like having that first bet can lead back to where you were. Even allowing myself this spending or this bad relation with money can also have that same effect. And that's the bit I'm always kind of thinking of. I have to be so vigilant around my behaviors, because they can or will lead back to addiction, which is somewhere I definitely do not want to go back to. But I still need to get that need met. And that's the frightening bit. And I try to get it met in other ways or in healthy ways, exercise, rest, diet. But I'll find excuses for all them stuff, because that's the hard way to do it. So I'm always looking for that easy way to get that need met. So it's an interesting thing, but it, for me to be, I suppose, because I work in the area, I'm constantly trying to think of my own triggers, my own risk situations, my own. And I don't think it's going to be the Ray Winstons of this world will bring me back gambling. Even though I will say, when there's a certain odd mention, that gets you thinking in different ways around it. Or if you overhear a conversation and someone talking about bet, you nearly have a phantom bet in your head of, is that going to happen? What I think is the internal stuff, or my internal triggers, are the ones that I have to constantly work on. Do you find that in your own recovery, or if you've...
No, that was really interesting to listen to, actually, because no, I'm a bit different. I'm a bit different. I think if anything, so like I did a video, and it was like holding a bottle of wine or whatever, and it was, you know, you wouldn't spend, I wouldn't spend more than £10 on a bottle of Bordeaux, but I would have 500 quid on Bordeaux FC. You know, it's like your relationship with money was so skewed. And I remember being in like the supermarket and, you know, I wouldn't spend a couple of quid more on the more expensive mayonnaise, right? But don't get the Hellmann's, right? Just get the Tesco one. It's £2.50 for mayonnaise. But I could be pushing the trolley, you know, keeping up to date on the apps. That's how my bets were going. I had like 500 quid on. But £1.50 more for the more, you know, more expensive mayonnaise was ludicrous. So I've had to almost like retrain myself to actually buy stuff for myself. So I'm almost the opposite to you, I think. It's because, you know, in addiction, I would wear the same clothes and I kept the same car for years and stuff. And all of my money was from gambling, because that's where I wanted it to be. You know, that was my first priority with my finances. So I've almost had to retrain myself to be like, no, like, if you do want that, you can have that. You know, you don't have to justify winning a bet to have that. Just have it. So I've almost had to retrain my mind to actually accept. And I'm lucky, you know, I managed to get myself out with my gambling debt and stuff. So, you know, I'm really fortunate with that. But yeah, I've sort of very grateful that I can spend money if I choose to. But there's a little part of me that's probably like, no, you might need that for the punt, you know. For me, I think how it manifests itself more is in time. You know, when you're gambling, you're constantly on edge, you're in a rush because you're checking your bet. You could be out with friends or family or partners and you're preoccupied, you're distracted. I find that myself. So I really like cooking. So recovery needs replacement and stuff. And one of the big things for me was I'll be in the kitchen with music on or a podcast and that's my space away. Instead of watching football 6 nights a week, you know, I'll actually put time into doing stuff. Whereas before, you know, I would still perhaps be cooking, but I would be burning food and looking at screen and, oh shit, I forgot to take out because I'm on my phone just putting another in-play bet on. And I still find that, I don't know if it's like an impatience thing or, you know, just such a learned behavior from addiction that I constantly find myself rushing when I don't need to, because I was always rushing to get back to the screen or to get back to my phone, which, you know, obviously I don't need to be, I don't want to be now. So.
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely the ability to slow yourself down. I think that's the bit I probably struggled most over the last number of years. And then I think when you are slowed down, you feel uncomfortable. You're nearly like drawn towards chaos then, or I need to be busy. And I find that in work, like when we came back from after Christmas, January was a little bit quieter to start because I'm doing a lot of school talk. So they weren't kicking in till the end of January. And I was, you know, I had really good balance in my life. I was energized. And then suddenly when the school talks kicked in again, my head just went busy again because it was 100 miles an hour again. And then when you're in that frenzy, you're nearly inviting more of that in. So I think it's the ability to be able to pull yourself back out of that constantly. And that's mindfulness or mindful living. The ability to be able, when your head goes 100 miles an hour, the ability to be able to say stop and pull yourself out of it. With the money, I think I did learn, I think following coming out of prison and rebuilding my life, I was on social welfare payments. I didn't have a lot of money. And I found that I was able, once I didn't have access to the money, I was able to manage that a lot better. But as soon as I got back working again, it was like the behaviors came flying back in again. I need to buy. I remember thinking like when the gambling stopped, there was a real fear. There's two real big fears. One was how am I ever be able to watch football without placing a bet on it again? Because one had become so intrinsically linked with the other. But the other one was I'll never have money again because I'm not, you know, you go to that black and white thinking or catastrophizing and I'm never going to get a job again. I'm never going to do this. And I really felt fearful in that. I think then when I did get the job, I was really like, all right, I need to kind of go and buy everything. And I had to really manage that. Now I'm starting to manage it a hell of a lot better than I was. But in moments, I think in moments it comes back in. So at the start, I would have been very much dominating my thinking. Where now is my thinking is generally, I throw myself into lots of different things, but it comes back in every so often. And that's the bit, but I'm very aware when that happens. And then I reset and I pull myself back. And I'm okay with that. It's not like it's never as bad as going back gambling, but I know it's similar behaviors. And I'm able to kind of just pull myself back every so often. Is it 100% right all time? Far from it, but I have a really good awareness around it. And sometimes I allow myself go with it because I kind of go, you know what, you deserve it. But sometimes then I kind of allow myself go with it too much, thinking, oh yeah, you definitely deserve it. I have to kind of say no. And in fairness, myself and partner, we do the budget, and I would have never done that before. She knows exactly the money coming in and going out. I would have always held back a little bit more, but I had a kind of a moment there a while ago where I just said, right, I need to put everything on the table and stop myself even spending those bits of money secretly. Like there's I was only going through my wardrobe. There's stuff in my wardrobe still with labels on it that I bought 2 years ago before the pandemic that, oh yeah, I'll be able to fit into that now in a while. Yeah, sure, I'll buy that Tommy Hilfiger hoodie. It's still there with the label on it. I still have more, but I had to buy it on that day. So that I have constant reminders of that and football jerseys and, you know, and I've spoke about this on the podcast numerous times, but it's that want, I want, I want, I want. But now I'm able to kind of
stop myself and say, right, you don't really need. And again, I talked about a couple of weeks ago about the documentary Minimalism on Netflix was really got me thinking in that way. And I got really good at kind of minimizing it. But every so often then I'll drift back into old behaviors when it comes to spending. And that's, for me, that's the journey of recovery. It's not just recovery from gambling. It's learning how to enjoy life for what it is. Learning to kind of, for me, it's about learning of thinking about, you know, I don't have to be constantly, you know, hitting that dopamine hit. It's okay to settle and be happy with what you have. And, you know, I am, as I said, I'm gone really, really good at it because, but then in other areas, I've gone really bad at it because the start of the year, come January, I was on a line. I booked 5 trips for the year, like our 2 main holidays and then all these different trips to watch concerts. And then I'm kind of looking at going, I can't afford any all of this. So I have to go now and rejig them and relook them. But the impulsivity made me book them because it was like, right, we're opening back up. My holidays are back full this year. Let's go and book all these things. And then you're kind of left in chaos thinking, oh, gee, I never thought I would have to take time off, or my parents take time off, or we have to put the dog into the dog house, as his local place where he goes to. And you don't factor in all those stuff. And it's something kind of, you feel very vulnerable then around money. And then that can lead back to thoughts of, oh, maybe I could just, gamble a bit, or maybe I could just do whatever. You know yourself, the thoughts and feelings behind it.
Yeah. So no, it's really interesting because it shows that like recovery is, that it really isn't like one size fits all. It's so different. And as I say, I've been fortunate and I've managed to save up, a house deposit and, which is, I had a house deposit saved like 2 years ago. And I've been lucky enough to just be able to add to it and add to it and add to it. And all of my friends are saying, it's like, well, you need to buy. And for me, I think, because I've seen places I've liked and I've put a few offers in, I've worked for a reason, none of house has actually materialized in the end. And I still think it's a bit of trauma from the addiction. So I don't want to give this money away because I was so used during the addiction to being in debt and never having any money. It's like, now I've got this money saved. It's like, I'm very protective over it and I don't want to lose it. And I feel it's almost like spending that much to put money on a house deposit would feel like it's being lost.
Or wasted even though it's a house.
Right. Yeah. Like what have I got for it? Yeah.
That kind of thought is mad how that creeps in, isn't it? It's mad how that creeps in. I'm mindful of time, I suppose, just quickly, maybe just to kind of speak a small bit about, like we talked about recovery a good bit, and you're dead right, it's not one size fits all. There's plenty of different pathways into recovery, and it's really good. Like my recovery might necessarily work for you, might necessarily work for someone else, but it's about people finding their own recovery and be able to be consistent in that and disciplined in that, whatever that might be. So I suppose your own recovery, just to maybe give us a bit of a snapshot about when you decided that, enough's enough or I need to get help. And usually, unfortunately, it's usually at that low point or that rock bottom. So what kind of happened around 2019 that made you decide that?
So my recovery started really in gambling addiction. You're never in control, but there are times when you feel like you're in control. But towards the end of mine, it really did feel like a train going off the tracks, it's high-speed train, and it was getting more and more reckless. The amounts of money were coming more and more and more. And I received a bonus from work. I get like a quarterly bonus, and a quarterly bonus coming through of 10 grand. And in that week, my dad, he was in hospital for like a month. He was quite seriously ill. Fortunately, he got through it, but I was his sole carer. So I was in hospital every night, and in times of stress, gambling was my medicine. It's what I looked to make myself feel better. Obviously, foolishly, because obviously it always, invariably made you feel worse. But and I lost the 10 grand in a week, and that was due to go towards a house deposit. And that was the moment I had to come clean, to my partner at the time. So from there then, because you need acceptance in addiction, and I feel like I had the acceptance for quite a while actually, but because I didn't have any accountability, because I wasn't honest with anyone, the acceptance alone wasn't enough. So it was only when I was finally accountable and told someone that I finally, you know, found the strength and had the support to do it. And I read your book, mate. I read your book in January 2020. I was like a couple of weeks in. And then I started to piece together some bits and I could really relate to some of the stuff that you did and the stories that you were telling. And then I joined the Twitter social media stuff, started the gambling card bits. GA, Gamblers Anonymous, for me, didn't work. You know, nothing against people. It's obviously you have thousands of people, but for me, it didn't work because I finally got to the point where I was starting to learn to be honest. So the practice of being in a meeting, but then not being able to discuss what you discussed in a meeting, it just didn't sort of sit with me. So personally, that didn't work. Had some addiction counseling sessions, but I really stumbled and made a bit of a lash up of the first probably 8 months of recovery. I became obsessively, wouldn't want to use the word addicted, but I became completely obsessed with work, was working ridiculous hours, you know, throwing myself into that as a distraction and a coping mechanism because, you know, at the time I was still really, really wanting to bet, you know, most days. Successfully avoided having a bet, but still wanted to. And then it was 8 months into recovery, I did what's called a subject access request, where you can apply to the bookmakers and it will give you all of your account statements and all of the history, of all of your bets over the years. And it took me months to actually then have the courage to open it up once they sent it to me. And it was sitting in my inbox marked for a while. Finally, one day I decided to do it. And then for me, getting the figure, it was 447,000 over 12 years, which is, that's averaging about 37,000 a year. And that was over 15,000 bets, which averaged out to be 3 bets a day, every day for 12 years. And then when I got all those statistics through and the amounts, I finally then found a bit of peace. And then, you know, could almost say to myself, right, and I will never add a single penny to that again. Whereas up in the beginning 8 months, I sort of stumbled my way through it. Couldn't watch football because I wanted to bet on it. And so I would say it was doing the subject access for me that was absolutely massive, beyond obviously just talking and sharing my story.
Brilliant. It's great to hear that as well, because it's a different approach, as you were saying, can work for different people. And it is a journey. And I think that's the most important message that I try to get across with client work or in chatting to people. It's a journey. It's not going to be always brilliant. At the start, you know, you get that initial respite and everything's good, but then you go through a lull and it does, you're kind of just, sometimes you're just holding on week to week. And the most important thing is just not to gamble and trust the process, because it does improve. And there is those moments in recovery where it's just something clicks and it's just different. And in your case, you're saying it's looking at those figures and deciding I'm never going to give them a penny again. Mine is kind of really like, yeah, I could go back to gamble and I could walk out of the office here this evening and go down to a local bookmakers and gamble if I wanted, but I know what will happen. And I suppose that's what all the clients or everyone I've talked to over the last 10 years have given me, because they've shared their stories with me and had the courage to do that. But that grounds me on a day-to-day basis that I can never go back to do this, because I will go back to where I was or where that person is in this moment. And for me, yeah. That's my kind of way of continuing my recovery. It's really interesting. So I got one of those subject access requests before. There's a lot of black marker on my one, but my gambling history, I'll never forget the day I got that. And I got the initial page on the front of it, and I didn't know how much recycled money was in it. And I kind of was just kind of, I had only 6,937 online bets, but they're all accumulators. I was 1,106 pages of this stuff, and it was all lengths of the accumulators. And it was always that. I remember looking at it and we saw the figure. I'd never forget what it was. I was working that day when I got this big envelope with it off my solicitor for the court case, and my friend went through it. And I was just looking at the bets and kind of going,
Jesus Christ, like how, like what kind of mindset was it? You're looking at huge bets. You're looking at the You're looking at the type of bets, the amounts of time you spend doing it. And you're kind of going, how did it get to that? And that was the, I think having that document, and even when I'm doing the school talks, I, you know, you would show elements of that sometimes in the talks. And each time I look at that, I have an 11-minute video. I would have posted before of one particular weekend where I won a load of money, but then lost it. And even looking at it, each time I watch it, I see different bets. And I find myself just shaking my head going, what is even that? I don't even know what it is. Is it a tennis player? Is it a football team? I didn't know what it was. And it was that, I think watching back on that really reminds me of the madness where my head went to in gambling. And my head is still mad in lots of ways, but I never wanted to go back to that kind of, back to where I was just before it came to light. And that's the thing that keeps me going in recovery. So it's great, I think, for anyone listening who is in recovery or is maybe in early recovery, it's not all, you know, roses the whole way through. Like you said, 8 months, you were kind of, you know, you didn't gamble, but, you know, there was elements of it wasn't. But then something clicked and you were there. And then it's just maintaining that as you're going along. So it's really good to hear that it was something different than maybe the norm. And it's also great to hear that putting yourself out there has helped you in recovery as well. Because it's not an easy thing to do. Like from someone who has very much put myself in the public domain as well, and you put yourself out in the public domain, it, you know, you will get messages that aren't quite complimentary. You will get people will comment and say you're this, you're that, you're what. I think it's about what we get from it, but also the message that we share can give hope to other people. And I think that's the thing that drives me. And it's an extremely courageous thing to do, because mine was taken away from me because my story just went out there. And for me to come back and rehash that, it took a lot to do it. But, you know, for anyone like yourself, Stacey, you know, just plenty of people, and I could name everyone in on this, the Twitter kind of recovery posse, as they call themselves, and we all call ourselves. It's really important to kind of, for anyone listening in that, you know, it's not everyone's cup of tea to go out and share it publicly. Some people might even share it to close friends, but it has helped you in recovery, and everyone's recovery is different. So it definitely has helped me in my recovery.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, as you say, it's not all roses, and it's not, you know, recovery is really hard.
Yep.
You know, recovery is not easy, but recovery is, you know, it sounds a bit spiritual, whatever, but recovery is rebirth. You know, it's an opportunity to be a completely different person. And there's so many things that once I got my head around the financial loss, you know, then I could try and start to understand, you know, the other stuff I lost, the relationships, you know, the friendships and all the rest of it. And the time, you know, in so many, you know, key moments in my life, you know, I look back to weddings, you know, I'm not proud of any of this, you know, but weddings, funerals, you know, work meetings, you know, evenings out, family meals, Christmas days. So many of them were tarnished by gambling, you know, and one of the big things for me is always a constant reminder. If occasionally you are like, oh, you know, you have a little hunch that a team will beat a team, or, you know, someone will win that fight or whatever. One of the big things for me is looking back at the, you know, so many iconic sporting moments, you know, when there's like, you come before a World Cup, or there's always this day 10 years ago, this day 20 years ago. But I remember the Aguero goal, you know, Man City, QPR, Man City won the league, probably the best moment in Premier League history. For me, I had been frantically backing and then laying off QPR because I think they went a goal up early, and then Joey Barton got sent off, and I had this position on QPR. And then Aguero's goal actually, you know, destroyed all of that for me. So I'm a neutral, you know, I was Spurs. I had no horse in the race, you know, emotionally, as 2-1 between City and United. But that moment was completely tarnished for me in my memory because I lost X amount on backing QPR. Same as the big fights, Tyson Fury's big wins, you know. Yeah, he won, but I had him to win by knockout and ended up winning by points. Or I had him to win between rounds 7-12 and he knocked him out in 4. You know, so many of your key sort of sporting memories are tarnished. So there's a big freedom in in sort of, you know, being proud of the fact that you can enjoy sport without without capital, because you can.
Yeah, definitely. And like, you know, I'm able to enjoy sport for what it is now. And but also my relationship with sport is a lot different than what it was. I watch matches that I want to watch, not because I have a bet on it. And that's the thing. And I remember even 2005, just to finish up, 2005 when Liverpool won the Champions League, one of the biggest kind of, you know, greatest comeback in Champions League history. And, you know, I have all these different bets on Cissé to score first and he didn't start and all this. And my whole night was dominated by all these bets I had on it. I had about 100 different bets on that match. And then my friend at the end of it came up and said, I had a pound on them on 3-3 at 100-1. And I said, and he was delighted himself. And we drank that. Well, here's I after losing hundreds on it, if not thousands on it. But yeah, well, yeah, it was just, and it's that iconic, those iconic moments. You're dead right that, you know, and also I think phone use can ruin those as well. Because if you're on phone and you're on Twitter, you're texting stuff, you're not watching the event for what is a really soaking in. So I try to leave my phone away when I'm watching matches. Or my biggest pet hate, people at concerts and have the phones up.
Oh yeah, the biggest thing, like you said, it's the biggest thing that's actually not watching as much.
Yeah,
I probably watch maybe two games a month. Maybe, you know, if there's a big game, you know, I don't spend every evening now watching the likes of Fulham versus Huddersfield, you know, which
or Spurs
would occupy all of my life. I try to still watch the occasional Spurs game.
I've games, but after that, I tend to pick and choose. Anyway, I won't take up any more of your time, Nick. Thanks a million again for coming on. And if anyone wants to check out your videos, it's at Gambling Guard. Is that on Twitter, isn't it?
Yeah, at Gambling Guard. It's on TikTok, Instagram, and Twitter. I've pulled back a little bit from Twitter and Instagram, so it's mainly on TikTok now. But yeah,
I may open an account though, because I've kind of noticed that there's not as much on Twitter. So I may open up an account and check it out and check out what my daughter is doing on it as well. So thanks a million for coming on.
My pleasure.
It's been an amazing to have to chat. I could stay and chat until 11 o'clock, but you have things to do, and I definitely have client work to do and stuff. And Barry's a hard taskmaster. You'd be whipping it.
Passing my best.
I surely will. I'm sure he's raging. He wasn't on today, but he'll get to listen back when he's doing all the edits and all the hard work that he does. So thanks a million again for coming on, and chat to you soon.
Cheers, Tony.
The Problem Gambling Podcast is proudly sponsored by Gamban, the simple and effective way to block access to online gambling on all your devices. If willpower slips, Gamban doesn't. Go to Gamban.com to find out more.